Future Friday. Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Future Friday with me, Hamish Hallett, and John Beasy. For this week, we are going to speak about the future of space. So a very interesting topic. As we've seen, there's a bit of like interest growing in the space industry. And yeah, me and John will speak about this for today's episode. So John, what is the current state of the space industry, if you can kind of describe it?
I would say small, but bigger than it was before. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more private corporations getting involved. It was largely just space agencies. You had NASA, India, China, and the Europeans, and now you're getting more private companies getting involved in trying to get out into space. You have SpaceX, Virgin, Galactica, among others.
Mm-hmm. No, that is interesting. Yeah, because I was kind of looking into it. It definitely seems that a lot more private companies are going into it, which is interesting, actually. In fact, as well, it's like, even though this isn't a developed market, but even like space tourism is becoming an idea heavily mentioned quite recently. Even though it's not taken off, it's still kind of becoming, it probably will become a big idea in the future, probably. Don't you think?
Oh, definitely. It's just a matter of bringing down costs. I mean, the world is a much wealthier place than it was 50 years ago, and we can now have that kind of wealth where even private corporations can start getting involved in trying to do that. And I'm sure space tourism and the $1 million tickets they sell are what are going to help drive down those costs, and along with potential resource extraction.
Yeah, because I actually found out that a cost for, because this is from like one source, that cost for a ticket for a commercial spacecraft would be around $250,000 to tens of millions of dollars, which is crazy. Absolutely crazy, the fact that that kind of money is being mentioned. This was mentioned in an article by Royal Museums Greenwich, which is, what is the future of space travel? So it's the fact that, yes, we can definitely see private companies kind of becoming more and more sort of invested in space. And also you have these kind of traditional players still with, the government and intergovernment space agencies as well, because we have 70 different government and international and intergovernmental space agencies, but 13 of them have the space launch capabilities, the likes of NASA and people like that. So I think, even though yes, private companies are still being growing, there are still, I think, big players like NASA still being part of it. So I think
they're still the ones leading the.
Yeah, I feel like NASA is the one leading. Yeah,
they're the ones that are. I mean, the private corporations are out there, but they're not really the ones driving it. They're not really. At this point, they're largely still kind of. We're trying to get tourism, maybe to try to get going, but they're not the ones sending off rovers and doing it for. And doing it for research purposes, because there is a treaty, a UN treaty that governs the moon and other activities in space, called the Outer Space Treaty, which was signed in 1967, which declares that space and other, well, not space, but the moon and other celestial bodies are the common heritage of mankind. And so they are not subject to sovereignty. You can't mine it, or... You can't, it's kind of gray on resource extraction, but it basically says that no one can claim sovereignty over it. No one country can control it. You can't place weapons of mass destruction in space.
Yeah.
You can militarize, but you can't put like nukes.
Yeah, pretty much. It's kind of like a treaty that kind of says, no country can literally own the moon. It's only like, I don't want to say the moon's like a shared
of mankind.
Yeah, you could say it's like, I'm not saying it's like a shared commodity, but maybe it's.
Well, that's the thing, is it doesn't say no one organization legally owns it. No one owns, there's no legal status of ownership over the moon.
Yeah, exactly.
Not even the UN.
That's the thing, because maybe, could the UN maybe own it and then it stops one country having it? I don't know.
Well, we don't need to have a concept of who owns it. It doesn't have to be anyone that owns it.
Yeah.
It's not like everything in the world has to be categorically hierarchically organized into, relationships of ownership. It can exist out there and just be there, and people can go out and commonly organize and, exploit it the best way in a responsible manner.
Yeah.
But there was actually a following up to the Outer Space Treaty. There was also the Moon Treaty, which was signed in 1979. But the Space Treaty was signed by most countries. But the Moon Treaty, on the other hand, is, I think, the most important countries that have signed and ratified it are Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Australia, and the Philippines. And the Netherlands and Belgium. And that's about it, along with some smaller countries. And it has the same kind of provisions as the Moon Treaty, but it adds some ones to better lay out, to better define the kinds of how to perform resource extraction, and puts greater limits on militarization of space.
That's fair enough. Yeah, that's interesting. Definitely having those treaties in place, it can definitely at least provide guidelines for states. But of course, with any treaties, sometimes some countries might even break them. You never know. That's definitely a possible future, I would say. It just depends who will do it. It's like even if there's a goalie protecting the goal, and let's say the goal is the moon, states can still try and find a way to, get past the goalie, and claim its land. Potentially, there might be a possibility of that.
Sure. I would say it's, these are treaties that were signed in the 60s and 70s. The world's changed a lot since then. We now have, we're kind of starting to have the possibility of thinking what if we mining asteroids might actually be something feasible that could be done, in the foreseeable future. What's possible now is much different than what was possible back then. And the framework that we've established, in the past might not work anymore in the future. We might have to, so rather than try to constrain ourselves to these previous and older rules, we might have to, come up with new rule sets.
Do you know this? You might not know this, but do these kind of treaties get renewed at all? Or do they get reviewed, or do they get, do they get reviewed?
To my knowledge, they get reviewed unless there's a sunset clause in the treaties. They get reviewed when the parties decide they want to review it.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, yeah, because I was just wondering, because maybe these treaties get reviewed every year, or maybe every 5 or 10 years, maybe. But that's fair enough. Okay, that's understandable. But yeah, my kind of other question really is, why is there such an interest in space kind of re-emerging? Because, we've had, of course, the famous, Apollo missions occurring, the first man going onto the moon. And then sort of since then, even though there's these kind of little undercover missions missions going on, there's not much media traction on that. However, of course, we got the growth of these big companies that now want to launch people into space. Ultimately, why has space been, the interest of space been reemerging? What has triggered it, really?
I'm not sure necessarily why it's coming back, but I think part of it is the world's much wealthier. We can kind of afford to do these things now. I mean, back then, China was hardly have any of the money it had. China got out most of its wealth in the last 20 years or so. So they couldn't have done anything like that in the 70s. Same with India. The world's a vastly wealthier place now. we have more people that can actually, you know, do these kinds of things. The world's also much better educated. And I think, yeah, part of it is also the fact that we're kind of having emerging rivalries coming back up. I mean, I think one of the big drivers of the space race during the Cold War was the fact that it was in that Cold War context. And once the Americans kind of, you know, demonstrated their quote unquote scientific superiority by landing on the moon, they kind of felt like, okay, well, we did the thing. They didn't really want to, you know, landing on the moon's a really cool and impressive thing, but it was largely, you know, a stunt to show the world, hey, look how much more impressive we are than the Soviets. Not, hey, we, you know, genuinely care about scientific exploration, and that's the sole exclusive purpose of it. So once it kind of, you know, stopped having that role, they're kind of, yeah, I guess we're kind of done with it. But then again, you did have, the US did have space, there was a Star Wars in the 80s, which was a whole controversy.
Yeah, no, that's true. You have like media kind of, you also got like space films as well. And media actually becoming a lot more interested in space movies as well. So it's like, even not just on a governmental level, but on like a consumer level and more like directing films or TV shit series, space has now been deeply obsessed by it as well, which is quite interesting to see.
That's the thing. I don't know whether there was that same kind of cultural disinterest in space, because, you know, once after the moon landings, that's when you get, you know, you get one, the American government's military project, Star Wars, and then you also have the actual media phenomenon that is Star Wars.
Yeah.
And then you have Star Trek and all those series. And yeah, I don't know if whether media itself is, I think it's more the political will for it. Because because previously it was, you know, solely and exclusively led by state governments, by governments. And well, NASA doesn't exactly get the same kind of budget as the military.
No, that is true, actually. And, but you know what, even, because I was thinking, actually, what would coronavirus have an effect on these kind of big space missions? And apparently, because I was kind of reading a few of these articles, I think they're still planning on doing these launches, which is interesting. Even though, because you kind of mentioned about, you know, NASA having a big budget and stuff like that, but maybe, you know, we might hit a big financial recession because of this virus that's going on. But apparently a lot of these big companies will still launch a few of these things. So for example, NASA, there's one article by Telesatrati, I think it is, and it's a guy called Eric Ralph, who said that NASA says that SpaceX astronaut launch debut is still on track despite the pandemic. And the fact this, they were still tracking to say will lift off in May 2020, so like literally next month. And the fact that I think a lot of them say that, you know, the International Space Station, for example, already operates with cleanliness and disease prevention. And you also see it as quote unquote a major priority. So maybe we, you know, even though like there's economic a downturn because of this virus, maybe, you know, these big space places still operate and still have the massive effect of launching their missions, which I thought was pretty interesting actually to look into.
Well, yeah, a lot of these private corporations are also, you have contracts with, say, NASA or whatever other government organization. So it's not like the cash flows have necessarily stopped, you know, some, especially if it's something that you've, you know, if you've been working and building this for years, and, you know, one little economic downturn is not going to have that kind of impact, you know, might impact future, you know, endeavors that are, you know, starting right now, but it's not, I don't think it'll heavily impact ones that are just end, you know, just about to, they're at the end phases of preparation.
Yeah. But also, like, I was thinking also, I thought the virus would also kind of impact, you know, workers working there. But actually, it seems that maybe it isn't, because they prioritize on disease prevention and things like that. And maybe because the amount of groups they work with, maybe it's much smaller, they're able to isolate a lot better compared to, let's say, I don't know, another industry. So that was also quite interesting to find out. as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they're already doing some work to make sure everything is sanitized, because you don't want your astronauts to get sick while they're in space. You need to make sure everything is safe and clean, and you don't want to contaminate other planets. You don't want other planets to contaminate us. So I really wouldn't be surprised if they already have protocols for sanitation and controlling of microbes or anything potentially infectious.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the fact that,
when Buzz Aldrin and they came back from the moon, they were in quarantine for 14 days just in case they might have contracted anything from the moon. Because, you know, it's first time on the moon.
Yeah, of course. That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. But no, that's interesting. And it's like, as well, I think space has also made a lot of progress, not just, you know, maybe finding out what is out there, if that's beyond the solar system and things like that. But apparently, like, it has allowed for humans, it has allowed humans to survive in space for a much longer time. So I think it was, I don't even know this person, but a guy called Valery Polyakov, I think it is, holds the record for the longest stay in space, and it was by 437 days. So it just shows, like, we could potentially have that ability of living in space for like more than a year, which is pretty impressive.
Well, that's that's the whole point of the ISS.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just, you know, reading. Sorry?
Is the test that, yeah. Is that, yeah, those experiments to see, you know, can people actually live in space? What kind of, you know, what kind of effects does zero gravity have on the human body?
Of course. But I was just very fascinated by it. I was kind of, it's interesting because it's, you know, the fact that we can, you know, space has developed, okay, I wouldn't say, maybe space has developed to that extent, but like our technologies, let's just say, have developed to allow that to happen, I think is quite remarkable, definitely. So it's definitely say that. So then, you know, we kind of did mention a little bit about, you know, China and India slightly growing into, you know, launching missions or already launching missions as well. And there's this kind of big quote, actually, which was a guy, well, the US Vice President Mike Pence said this back in May 2019. And this is what he kind of said in his statement, says, "Make no mistake about it, we're in a space race today, just as we were in the 1960s, and the stakes are even higher." So my kind of question to you, John, is, does a space race exist, pretty much?
That is a good question. It's hard to say, just because the Americans are very interested in kind of rebooting that whole Cold War 2.0 mindset, and very much trying to think of themselves in that kind of old great power competition. So it's easy for them to kind of go back and think, okay, if we're in the Cold War, then this is the space race. We're doing space race 2.0. We have that. So there's definitely those factors, but I'm not certain whether it's we have a different context now. It's not necessarily I guess there is a space race in the sense that, but not in the sense of who gets to go out and, you know, land on the moon first. I think it's who's going to be the first to try to project their force into space. And I think that's the American ambition with their space force, is to, you know, we want to see an air superiority, we want to have space superiority, we want to have superiority in every plane of battle.
Yeah, no, absolutely, that's fair enough. And especially if you have someone like Donald Trump, for example, in as a president, and the fact he's been so talking negatively about China, and, you know, how he sees China as this major threat. I think that's going to go on, not just, you know, economically, if that's like industry wise, but it's kind of definitely, I think, transpire to space as well, I think, which is interesting. So I think maybe Trump has a slight element to it. Maybe, I don't know, maybe not like an actual direct element, but the fact he's speaking about China in such a negative way, it's creating that rivalry, and that can be translated to space.
Yeah, it's definitely if the Americans are always kind of looking out and thinking, trying to find a rival, not to say that the Chinese are necessarily acting in, you know, in good faith. It's very possible that they can be working towards have more nefarious ends. But if you're trying to look out and trying to pick a fight, they will find what they're finding. You know, you always tend to have to find what you're eventually looking for if you look hard enough. And you know, it's possible they could perceive things that may not have initially intended to have been aggressive as potential aggression, which could escalate into actual aggression. And vice versa, the Chinese might see the Americans the same way, see something as, you know, a benign action that may take it as a threat.
And what would you say these threats are? Like, how can you define those kind of threats, would you say?
Well, let's say, I don't know, let's say they put up some kind of satellite system that could do whatever. There's something that might not, that... something that could have, say, useful scientific purposes, but maybe could also have military ones. I don't know. Let's say, I don't know, maybe one country put up a geosynchronous satellite that could help sling things to the moon to make transit to the moon easier. But that could also, say, sling missiles or whatever. You know, something that could have peaceful purposes that they may end up interpreting as, no, it's not the peaceful purpose they're using it for. They want it for the military one.
That's fair enough. Cool. Because, yeah, I was wondering, like, what kind of threats would it be? But it could even just be something that is investigating scientific research, or even, yeah, we just said, like, militarized as well.
Yeah, it's all about whether or not they believe what the other country's saying. They say, okay, we're going to do this because we want science, or, you know, we want, you know, for scientific purposes, or let's say for example, oh, we want to mine this asteroid because it contains a lot of gold or whatever, but in reality they want it for the uranium.
Yeah,
there's all sorts of different, it's all about whether countries believe what other countries are saying at face value.
It's like it's like kind of like bluffing, or it's like trying to bluff the other nation, pretty much, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of that.
Definitely.
You know, it's all about trust. It's, do you trust the other country? Do you have open lines of communication to make sure that the things are happening, that each side are, you know, are aware of the intentions of the other side? Because once you have misunderstanding of intentions, that's when you can have these, you know, potentially dangerous escalations.
I think right now as well, I don't think there's a lot of trust going on between nations. I don't think right now. So I think that's going to definitely increase the untrustedness.
Well, the Americans have certainly undermined their trustworthiness. So,
I mean, just, yeah, with this whole virus, but definitely. But yeah,
virus, like, Trump, yeah. 10 years, yeah, they're not a trustworthy nation.
No, of course not. I don't think anyone is, let's be honest. But yeah. What about we can definitely talk a little bit more about, you know, the kind of commercial space agencies. So, you know, we've got the likes of SpaceX, and you've got Virgin Galactica coming in. And I kind of found this kind of one quote, which was on SpaceX's website, which basically, SpaceX designs, manufactures and launches advanced rockets and spacecraft. The company was founded in 2002 to revolutionize space technology, the ultimate goal of enabling people to live on other planets, which is a pretty bold statement, let's just say that. So how will these big, you know, commercial space agencies affect space industry? Like, how will they affect this space industry? Especially when you've got what we've kind of mentioned, there's this kind of space race existing between, or it might be existing or not, between America and China, or these major countries. What will these commercial space agencies, how this will affect the space industry?
Well, at this point, they're not really the ones kind of driving it. I mean, none of these corporations are like solvent on their space endeavors solely. Mm. Like SpaceX is Elon Musk's, you know, space dream. And it, you know, it does, it's not profitable. The only reason why it's, it exists is because Elon takes the money from the profitable enterprises of, you know, Tesla and his other companies and funnels that towards SpaceX. The same thing with Virgin and the same thing with Galactica. They're all part of other larger companies that have other profitable industries that can sustain these unprofitable endeavors up until the point where they, you know, can generate profit.
Mm.
So at this point, they're still kind of, you know, they do, they highly publicize their, you know, their tourism, but, you know, they send up like, what, I don't know, two people a year. I don't know the numbers, but it's not like,
yeah, I've got,
you know, like, it's not like they're sending like dozens of people at a time. And, you know, they're largely just doing, you know, launching satellites for NASA or for X company or whatever. Mm. So, you know, they're doing it. They're doing stuff. They're doing research. They're doing the work that they can to bring down their costs. That's, you know, they have that incentive. But at this point in time, it's still, they're not the ones that are really leading the charge.
Yeah. Well, no, speaking about sending people up to like to space and stuff, I think but this was a statistic towards Virgin Galactica. Apparently they've offered 600 people. So 600 people have bought a ticket for Virgin Galactica, who they are offering the space, who are offering space tourists a chance to see beyond the Earth. So there are people out there. Of course, it's not like the everyday man or the everyday woman, you know, or, you know, the everyday someone, you know, it's the fact that probably those 600 people are literally billionaires, let's be honest.
So they have money to burn.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of like, you know, they have all this money to burn and stuff like that, which, yeah, maybe this space is only for the rich, not for, you know, the everyday person, which is another question in itself, really. Something that maybe we should consider.
Well, that's how it is for most technologies and most modes of transportation, is that they need to be initially brought down. The costs are usually initially too high to make it profitable and effective for mass usage. I mean, you know, cars didn't really take off in the United States until the Ford Model T. The Model T was not the first car, but it was one of the first, you know, factory, you know, had an assembly line that brought down the costs that could make it affordable for the everyday person. And then Ford, of course, invested to make sure that their workers could actually afford their own products. So right now space is going to be expensive, but I think that's largely because, you know, we haven't built up the proper infrastructure to really make getting in and out of space feasible. Because the big thing right now is, you know, is escaping gravity. And that takes a whole lot of energy. And the vast majority of, you know, whenever you see a rocket, the vast majority of it is just fuel cells that get dumped and left, by basically the moment it actually reaches space. And then has, you know, the tiny little cockpit, that's where the people are, and that's the tiny little thing. But the vast majority of the rocket is just fuel and rocket. Mm. So until we develop, you know, more efficient means, maybe some like magnetic slings or space elevators, other means of actually getting people into space, it's going to stay very expensive.
Yeah. It's like electric cars as well. It's like there's, even though you have like electric car companies like Tesla, for example, there's no sort of stock stations. So it's very similar to space. And that's why it's so expensive to own an electric car. So it's, yeah, it's very, very similar.
Kind of. Except imagine if your car was like 95%, like, so we're thinking of it this way. Imagine if your car was like 95% like fuel tank, and then you dropped it as soon as you got onto the highway and then it went on. Like, that's kind of how it is right now, is like the bulk of the energy and the weight is all just to get out into space. And then the majority, and then once you're out there, you don't really need it anymore, but you just need, but you need so much energy and fuel and just mass. And the fact that you need all that to escape gravity really limits how much stuff you can, you know, send out.
Yeah.
Because every pound, you know, every kilo is like an extra, you know, $20,000 or something in fuel.
It's crazy that. Yeah. What about the what about the environment though? Does all this affect the environment? Must do. Or does it not really?
That's kind of the thing with, you know, it depends on why you want to go to space. Do you want to go to space to, you know, escape what's happening on Earth? You know, is it you? Do you going to leave space? Do you want to do that because? Now, it's kind of the idea is for a lot of space people and say Elon Musk is to get, you know, we want to make sure that humankind becomes an international species. And, but sometimes that can mean, you know, okay, are we investing in trying to leave our planet because we think it's beyond repair? Or, you know, are we still capable of, you know, fixing it, but instead of trying to, you know, solve the social problems that cause these environmental problems, it's easier just to find a new planet to ruin and continue on with terrible social relations.
That's my worry about the future of space. It's like, why are we having this big interest in space? Are we literally trying to find another planet to like live on? And then surely we should try and learn from the mistakes of like what we've done to this Earth, you know?
It's kind of like the plot point of Interstellar, if you've seen that movie.
I think I might have not seen it. I obviously have heard of it. With
Matthew McConaughey, came out in 2014.
Yeah, I know the film. I just haven't watched it, I don't think.
It's very good. It's but that's kind of one point where so the main character, what used to be a pilot for NASA, but he never actually got out to go into space. He just did the training for it. And then he takes his daughter to school and his daughter finds out this is like a near future and like agriculture is dying. Like the only like staple food we have left is like corn. And it's dying and so they reveal that like, oh yeah, the space missions were faked in an effort to bankrupt the Soviets. And so when they tell him, you know, they say that in the textbooks, and he's like, what do you mean? You know, that's what I was doing. And he'd, you know, tell his daughter about, you know, the space and all that. And then the teacher would be like, no, we need to, you know, tell them about this planet, not dreams of leaving it.
Mm. No, that is interesting. Yeah. Because I think, there's a lot of different kind of films like that that try and do that. But it's definitely a possibility. You know, maybe we live, maybe the human race lives on another planet. But of course, what is that human race? Is it, you know, the everyday citizens that the rich, you know? But of course, it, you know, time will tell. You know, I think it's a question definitely in the next, 30 years? I don't know how long this will be. But it will definitely be a conversation a lot of states might talk about, definitely.
It'll definitely take a while. They're still trying to figure out whether or not you can create, you know, internal biospheres. I think there have been a couple of efforts into that, and whether you can have create a self-contained entire ecosystem as an effort to like, okay, well, can we do this for terraforming? And they haven't quite figured that out yet.
Interesting.
Like colonization might be a bit ways away. There can definitely be, you know, steps towards it, but I think what'll happen first is most likely resource extraction.
Yeah,
that's so getting out to the moon to mine it, get out to the asteroid belt. But proper colonization, that could be. Colonization will be different because it requires. It would require a lot more and different kinds of work than, say, resource extraction.
Yeah. And also they would use, because right now I feel like I've seen a lot of missions do use like a lot of robots, for example, on these. If they do put like something on a planet, it's most more likely than not a robot as well. So it's not like humans are doing it either as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's it'll most likely be drones. It'll probably be Centaur work. You know, the kind of, you know, making machines that can. It's a lot easier to make a machine that can actually, you know, exist in those conditions than try to change those conditions to make them suitable for humans.
Yeah. No, definitely. And it's even like, can we actually even live on a planet? You know, can we live on another planet like on Earth? You know, is Mars livable? Is all the other kind of planets, you know. But you never know.
That's the whole point of terraforming is can you change the chemical composition of the atmosphere to, you know, can you oxygenate it, fill it with more oxygen? I mean, can you have liquid water? Can liquid water exist there? And once you kind of have those basic conditions of a human-friendly atmosphere and liquid water, then you can theoretically start bringing in vegetation.
Definitely.
That's what they said is they believed was Mars used to be used to have a lot of liquid water and used to be quite and have a different composition to its atmosphere. It used to be a bit more Earth-like. So if planets and Earth used to be, you know, far more Martian and it used to be very volcanic and not hospitable to life at all. So planets themselves change naturally. So there's theoretically humans can direct that change.
Did Mars also have a river? Or maybe I've read something wrong. Did Mars have a river at one point?
I think Mars had an ocean.
Yeah, something like that, maybe. And now it's like completely dried out, I think. Maybe, I'm not too sure.
I think it's dried out, and I think there isn't any liquid water left, but I think it's all like ice at the caps.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But that's quite interesting. And, you know, I think this is kind of a good way to kind of find, like, put my kind of last question out. What is kind of the future of space, even though we kind of slightly talked a little bit about it, but like, yeah, what would you say is a conclusion? What is the future of space, do you think?
More stuff?
Yeah.
More space.
Yeah.
That's fair. We'll probably see some increased militarization of space. Military satellites and other installations. Likely see that. We'll likely see greater endeavors into, say, asteroid mining. Those will definitely be big things. I mean, a single asteroid could have trillions of dollars worth of resources. And the nice thing about it is you don't really have to worry about environmental considerations because there isn't really an environment.
Yeah.
No, the other thing is, but at the same time, is we do also have to start cleaning up our atmosphere because we already have some. There's already a lot of debris from old satellites up in space that kind of just hover around, just floating in space, and you don't want too much stuff to accumulate there to the point where they become dangerous for either things can't orbit properly because they keep crashing into each other, or debris falls down and, you know, rains onto Earth. So
there's all sorts
of stuff.
No, definitely. And also the fact that I think it was an estimate by 2030 that the global space market could be worth £400 billion, which is staggering. And it just shows you there's a real future of space being massively invested. If that's by a private company, if that's from states, you know, you never know. I think it's definitely, I think space will be definitely looked at in the future. When will this happen is, I think, another question. Definitely. So, but yeah, okay. I think we can definitely go to our weak signals. I think this has been a great conversation about space. But let's go to our weak signals. Should I go first, I'm guessing?
Go for it.
Yep, okay. So my weak signal is something around, this is called fava beans and how they could be the new soy. So this was an article by Ida Erickson from the university, and she basically did a study in the University of Copenhagen which was suggesting that fava beans could be a source of plant protein, which is a lot better for the environment than soy. So it's the fact that the reason why it's better environmentally is these beans, the fava beans, could be grown in Denmark and also the Middle East, China and Ethiopia. So the fact is, normally, let's take Denmark as an example country. Maybe they want to try and get, you know, a lot of soybeans and certain products from certain countries. They have to try and like import it from other countries. Now, this is going to cost a lot of money and will also cost a lot to the environment. But the fact they can grow it locally is much better for the environment because they don't reduce the amount of cost of doing it. And they're actually also, the why this better environmentally is because these beans don't have to be modified by something called herbicides. And actually soy actually gets modified by these herbicides. So it's much worse for you. It's like, well, not worse, not as bad for you, but like, in a sense, it's using these chemicals, which isn't very good for the environment. So that's two really big benefits. So the fact there's this research from this university of these beans just shows there's a new protein out there, like a new plant-based protein that is out there that can be grown within Europe. I think this is very, very important for a lot of countries to consider because I think, you know, we look at globalization, it does try and, you know, export a lot from different countries. And maybe if we could find these sources of these beans, we can grow it locally and it can create a much better sort of environment. So apparently this study, which the Copenhagen did, was trying to find what was the best crop or protein powder. And fava beans actually outperformed lentils, amaranth, buckwheat, and quinoa. So it just shows these beans are a lot better, can remain its natural color, and it has also a neutral taste, where some beans don't actually have quite a bad aftertaste sometimes. And it also has good texture. So yeah, it's a pretty interesting article I read on Futurity. About these beans. So yeah, what do you think about this, John?
Good. Soybean production takes up an area five times that of the UK. So it is important to reduce how much land and water goes towards it, especially since 80% of that soybeans go just to feed our food as animal feed rather than actually consumed by humans.
Yeah.
So yes, local production is always better in terms of say less need to get things around, less need to move things around, so you can reduce those costs. Do you know how much water or land it uses compared to soybeans?
That's a good point. I tried to look in a little bit more deep into this article. It didn't actually say how much they use water-wise. I don't think it did say that much about it. I can always look up a bit more. They can say that it's just locally grown, much more locally. But apparently, I think it uses less land, I think, than these soybeans. That's what it said. I think it said it was better environmentally than these soybeans, which uses these big, which you've been talking about, these large areas of land. So maybe it uses less land, but I think these beans do seem to be a lot better for the environment. But I think maybe further research probably needs to be.
Just by virtue of not having to move them, ship them across from wherever to wherever,
yeah,
it's good. But in terms of you're in a place where you can already produce soy, is it necessarily going to be something that's going to, if you're already producing soy, is it going to be something that you're going to be incentivized to produce instead of soy?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a good point.
For say countries like Denmark, where like they have to import soy, it was like, okay, well, yeah, now we can produce our own substitute. But if you're already making soy, then it's kind of like, well, do we want to do this? You know, is this better than soy for us?
I found another article actually. Apparently the UK actually have these beans as well, but they actually export it to countries in the Middle East. They're like to Egypt, which is interesting. So I think the UK even have these beans. So that's why I found one article as well. So, yeah.
Well, that's the other problem is it doesn't really improve the environment if it's exported anyway.
Yeah. Well, maybe there needs to be more of an incentive to, you know.
It only really works if everyone's producing, you know, their own food locally.
Yeah, exactly. It's a way of trying to maybe
replacing if it's replacing imports. But if you're substituting imports, but now you're exporting it, well, you're kind of in the same situation. You're just changing the flow. You're just reversing the flow of goods.
Yeah. Well, so maybe we might need to change it to like de-globalize, you know, production. You know, maybe actually not import, but locally produce these, you know, certain products like these beans, probably. But yeah, I think it was an interesting article which I found, and probably some I might actually do a bit more research into. But yeah, sorry, John, what was your weak signal as well?
I have one about replacing flesh with nanomaterial. So this is from the Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, where scientists made a non-toxic rubber-like material that could replace human tissues like cartilage and body modification, cosmetic and reconstructive operations. So it's made through a process called nanostructuring, where they take plexiglass, which is just a form of carbon, where it can be made into a very soft, flexible, and elastic material. And it can be structured in such a way as to allow the surface to be given a natural antimicrobial properties. And it can be 3D printed or injected as a liquid to form elastic structures within the body. And it can even be imbued with medicines to allow localized treatment released over time. And so this could be quite interesting for both for medical and aesthetic purposes. So it can be really useful in, say, reconstructive procedures and reduce the need for drastic operations. It can also serve as an alternative for Botox, which is a neurotoxin. It's only really safe in certain quantities. So this could allow for healthier and safer cosmetic touch-ups. And as a non-toxic material, it could even be used for, say, more drastic body modifications. I don't know if you saw this old trend some 7 years ago called the bagel head trend, where it was like people would put like saline in their forehead and then pressed it in. So it's kind of like a little bagel, had a little bagel shape right on your forehead. But the saline would be absorbed into the body and it would go away in a couple hours. This could be, theoretically, you could put in, have permanent things like that if you wanted to. You could, you know, maybe they put in horns or like little bumps or maybe like an embossed tattoo or even fake muscles. So,
yeah,
you know, in a world where people are increasingly representing themselves with digital avatars, maybe people want to alter their physical bodies to match their avatar and what they think is a more genuine expression of who they are rather than the other way around.
Mm. It seems like, I don't want to say it's like cloning, but it's like, actually it's not cloning, but it's kind of genetically modifying kind of thing. Ish, I don't know.
I mean, it's not changing the genome. I mean, none of these things get passed on to the person. It's more, think of it more like an implant.
Okay, yeah, that's awesome.
Like, think of it more like getting a boob job, basically.
Sure.
Like, it could be used for that, but instead, it's like, okay, and then maybe instead of, you know, having larger breasts, I want to have, you know, I want my tattoo to, you know, stick out just a little bit more, so it kind of looks, you know, has a texture and, you know, kind of stands out more. I don't know, maybe I want these giant bumps on my shoulders, because, I don't know, people want that.
Yeah, no, true. But, like, okay, so in that sense, it's much more, and you said it's kind of made from this kind of more of a natural material, or like a much more, more of a natural material as well.
Yeah, well, it's made from carbon. So that's what like most of the body is made out of. So it's a very, it's carbon and oxygen, whatever plexiglass is made out of. But it's, plexiglass is already used in medical procedures. And as you know, it has the same chemical composition as so many other things in the body. So it's not like you're putting in not foreign materials. These aren't going to be, these play well with flesh.
Yeah, because that's what I was thinking. I think sometimes with, you know, let's take it with like plastic surgery, sometimes they can sometimes put something which is quite, it just doesn't really react well with the body. But then this seems like it could react quite well with the body. And actually, well, were there any sort of results? Like, are there any sort of investigations to be like, are there any big side effects? Are there, you know, does it work? Or I don't know. Just say that.
Well, that's the thing is it's the material. It's like I said, they already use plexiglass in other kinds of surgeries. All this is just a different way of using plexiglass. So the material is already deemed safe for medical use.
Fair enough. All okay, this is sure.
Another form of that material.
Okay, cool. Cool.
No, in a form that can be more easily manipulated and more flexible for medical purposes.
Mm-hmm. Sure, that's fair enough. Okay, that's interesting. No, that's a really, really that's a very interesting way of looking at that weak signal. And yeah, all right, perfect. Do you have anything else to add, or is that it?
I am fine.
Perfect. All right, cool. Just want to say thank you, John, for today to give this discussion on space and also our weak signals. I hope everyone enjoyed that episode of Future Friday. You can listen to our episodes on Spotify, also Apple Podcasts as well. And hope you guys enjoyed and see you next week. Thank you very much.